And so we'd like to bring the speaker up here. It's going to be Ken B. for 25 years from Fresno.
My name's Ken. I'm an addict. I need to tell you that I'm grateful to be in a meeting in Narcotics Anonymous. And I'm real grateful to be clean today. You know, I may have to sit down here in a little bit, but we'll wait and see what happens. I want to welcome the people that are new. And I want to encourage you to keep coming back here. You know, I know that, you know, that's the kind of thing that kept me coming back, is that people, you know, recognized me and invited me back to meetings in Narcotics Anonymous. So, and I want to thank, in particular, I want to thank Rick and, you know, and Melanie for having me, you know, having me come up and share this meeting and providing me with the hospitality and the warm welcome that I got when I got here. And, I need to tell you also that I love Narcotics Anonymous. You know, this fellowship has done for me things that I never dreamed it could do for me. You know, my clean date is December 2nd, 1987. That's a little over 26 years. And I don't say that because it's an ego thing today. I say that because I want you to know that you can stay here. You don't have to go back out and do anything. This program works. This is a fellowship of love. You know, the people in these rooms will wrap their loving arms around you and protect you from this insidious disease that we all share. So, I thought I would talk a little bit about what it was like for me, you know, when I got here. And, you know, I came from a family that was really dysfunctional. In fact, not only the family was dysfunctional, the whole damn neighborhood was dysfunctional. we got to use at a young age. we got taught how to use, and you know, people saw to it that there was plenty of dope in the neighborhood, and you know what, man, it was okay. You know, I had five brothers and one sister, you know, we grew up in a little Hispanic neighborhood in Sacramento, in downtown Sacramento. And it was called Dos Rios. And you know, it was different growing up in a Hispanic neighborhood being black. You know, I never did learn how to speak the language, but I learned how to eat the food. You know, I tell my partners, you know, I have my feet under you know, the table with the tamales a lot when I was coming up, you know. And so I'm real grateful, man. And I'm grateful for the neighborhood that I grew up in. I'm grateful for the people, you know what, man, that, you know, that helped raise me, you know, because they were doing the best that they could do, you know. And I know that today, you know. But this disease is insidious. As I said before, this disease takes people places that they don't want to go. It takes families to places that they don't want to go. You know, and my family was no exception. You know, my two older brothers did a lot of time. I never went to prison because I always thought that going to prison meant, you know, that I was going to be this outcast like they were. You know, and they were, in my mind, they were outcasts. You know, they shot dope. I never shot dope, so I always thought that I was different. You know, they did armed robberies. I didn't do armed robberies. You know, so I always wanted to be something different, and I thought I was. You know, but the first time that I ever used any dope, you know, my older brother, I was up in his apartment. We were upstairs, and he had a pile of weed on the table, and he twisted up a big fat one and sparked it up and passed it to me. And two things happened in that moment. One thing was, for the first time in my life, I felt like I was a part of something. I felt like I belonged, and that it was okay. And the second thing was, is that after I took that first hit, I about coughed my ass off. And I should have known then that something was wrong. I should have known that something was wrong at that very moment. But what happened was, because as I walked down the stairs to leave his apartment, my body kind of separated from my mind. And all of a sudden, I became void of all my feelings. And it didn't matter what I looked like anymore. You see, it didn't matter where I came from or what the neighborhood was like. You see, that drug did for me what I couldn't do for myself. All of a sudden, my whole life changed. And I found a place that I loved. I really loved it, man. I enjoyed it. And every time that I got loaded from that day forward, and I used for over 25 years, that was what I was looking for, was that high. And I don't need to tell you that I never found it. Not again, not once. The whole time I used, I never found that first high. But every time I sparked up, every time I every time I used some kind of dope, no matter what it was, that was the place that I wanted to go. And, I guess I need to back up a little bit because, you know, like I said, I grew up in this neighborhood, but you know what, man? In my early childhood, I spent several years living with my grandparents in a little town in Arkansas, a little town called Rise in Arkansas. And in that town, you know, it was predominantly a black community. And you know what? And my grandparents were very, you know, they were prominent people in the church and in the community. And you know what, man? And I remember how I felt, you know, because, like I said, I came from six, a family with seven kids, and my two older brothers were at home, and when I went back to live with my grandparents, my father was going overseas because he was in the military, and so my mother thought it would be best to send us back with grandma for a couple of years, you know, while he was away, and she was pregnant with my sister, so, you know, that was just too many kids for her to handle. And I remember the love that I received at my grandparents' house. You know, I remember getting up early in the morning and following my grandfather to work. He'd get up early in the morning and he'd hook up the mule to a sled and he'd go out and he'd cut pulpwood in the woods in Arkansas. And that's what he did for 50 years of his life. He was a hard-working, very strong, good-looking fellow. I won't say I took after him, but you know, but he was a very, 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 very special man. And you know, he raised 13 children. He never raised his hand to one of them. You know. But believe me, if he ever told you to do something, you did it. Just because you respected him. That's the kind of man he was. And I always wanted to be like him. And I always thought that I could be just like him. You know? And I remember that one morning I walked with him down the road, and this dirt road, and he was going to get the mule, and he was walking kind of fast, and I was I was very little, and I couldn't keep up. And he reached down, he picked me up, and he put me on his shoulder. And he carried me down the road. And I remember how I felt in that moment. I felt so secure and protected. And I didn't have nothing to worry about in this world. And I really have good memories of that life, of that time in my life. And I grew up in this neighborhood, I started using dope, and everything in my life changed. You know, I became more popular with the women, you know, with the girls in the neighborhood. You know, I became more popular at school, you know, because I was hanging with the stoners. And at that time, you got to realize, I grew up in the 60s, and that was the time when, that culture was okay. You know, it was okay. You know, love, peace, and drugs. We did. You know, and music, rock and roll. You know, and I tried to have all of that. You know, and I'm not sure, man, when the unmanageability started. You see, it started for me at some point. And I'm not real sure exactly when it was, but it was a time when, you know, I had met this woman and we had gotten together. She had three children, and we moved in together and we started raising these kids, and I was trying to use and work, you know, and do all of these things, and it became very difficult. And I think that's really when the unmanageability started for me. You know, I think the party was over at that point, and I just didn't know. You know, because I was trying to use everything and anything I could get in my body. And I continued to progress. My disease continued to progress, and my use continued to progress. You know, and one day I found this drug that I thought was the utopia. drug called cocaine. And my brothers, like I said, they shot dope, and I always looked down on that, because, you know, I didn't ever want to be like that, you know. So I thought if I used this cocaine, I'd be okay. You know, I wouldn't be like that, you know. And that's where my ego took me. See, I forgot to tell you that I have this ego that's as large as this room. And it takes me places sometimes that I don't want to go. I started using this drug, man, and it got progressively more expensive to keep up with. I decided that after a while, I decided that things were just really crazy in Sacramento, and that maybe if I could just get away from all the people that I was around, and I could start a whole new world, you know, a whole new life. So I packed up everything and I moved to Fresno, and I brought my wife and my kids here within the year after that, and I got this job, and I just knew that I was going to be okay, you know. And I wasn't going to use any more dope, you know. So I started going out after work with the fellas, you know, and we hit the local bar. And I remember drinking until, you know, 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning and staggering in the house. But I thought that was okay, man, you know, because I wasn't using, you know, I wasn't using anything, and I just knew that it was, you know, that was fine, you know. I didn't know anybody in Fresno, so I didn't worry about trying to find no dope, But it wasn't long, man. It wasn't long before I was right back in the bag, you know? It didn't take long, you know? And that's how this disease worked for me, you know? I got right back in the bag, and pretty soon my life was totally unmanageable one more time. And the problem with the move was that I took me with me. I didn't know that then. If I could have somehow left me behind, it might have worked. But I took me with me, and when I did, I found out that that the geographical just didn't work. You know, and I didn't know it was a geographical until I got here. You know. So anyway, I remember I got into this bag real deep one day, you know, and I was into this cat for a whole lot of money, and you know, he was pressuring me to pay him, and you know, and I was deep into his bag, and I remember coming home one day. Well, let me back up for a minute, because see, I worked at this facility that had a drug treatment program in it. A residential program inside the facility where I worked. And I can remember, because I used to go out there on weekends and work on weekends, and I remember I'd be standing outside of the building, and there were these trailers that were out in front of the building, right? And they were being used as a conference room. And on Sunday morning at about 10:30, these people would show up. And I'd be standing out there watching these people show up, and you know, what the hell are these people doing here this Sunday morning? This ain't no church, you know? And so I asked somebody one time, I said, what are these people doing here? Who are these people? They said, oh, that's Narcotics Anonymous group. And they come here on Sunday mornings. And I said, Narcotics Anonymous? Oh, I'm glad I don't have no problems like that. And I went on and proceeded to go back in the back of the building somewhere and get loaded, you know. And things just continued to progress, man. And I remember that one day I was walking around up on this unit where this drug treatment program was, and as I went around the corner, I saw this guy in the hallway, and he says, "Hey, come here." I said, "Yeah." He says, "Look, here's my card. If you know anybody that needs help, tell them to call me." And I said, "Oh, okay. I don't know nobody needs no help, so, you know, I'll do that, man. Thank you." You know? And I went on about my business, man. And I don't know, I guess it was like a couple of weeks later, I came home from work. You know, I say work, man. I wasn't producing anything at work, but I was going every day, and things were really starting to unravel, you know, in this job that I had, and you know, my attendance was bad, and my performance was bad, and you know, things were just beginning to unravel because most of my time was spent trying to find ways and means to get dope. Because I would get up in the morning and I would take the wife to work, you see, because she had to make sure she got to work. You know, even if I didn't get there, she had to get there. You know, and then I would proceed to go to the dope man's house, and then I'd try to get enough dope to last until I could get back to the dope man's house, which would be about 10, 11 o'clock. See, and I'd head back to the dope man's house and get some more dope to last until noon. You know, because I know I needed to make sure I had enough dope to last till noon. And then try to get enough dope to last until the end of the day so that I could make sure that, you know, after on the way home, pick her up, I could stop and get some more on the way home. You know, but that's how I did it. I spent every waking moment trying to find ways and means to get more. And this day I came home, man, and I walked up to the house after I pulled in the driveway there, and there were these suitcases sitting on the porch, right? And I said, "Well, maybe somebody came to visit." Hold it, man. Somebody's coming to visit. I don't know. don't know how many of y'all know what a crack house looks like. Okay? The inside of a crack house? Well, that's what my house looked like. Okay? But we didn't do any crack. But that's what my house looked like. We had sheets on the windows, mattresses on the floor, there was no furniture in the living room, no food in the refrigerator. You know, and I'm driving a 1964 red Ford Fairlane, Ford Falcon with a green hood. Okay? And it's looking good, baby. And I'm looking good in it. You know, even if I do have to push it halfway to the gas station to get a couple of dollars in it, you know? And then go to the dope man's house short. You know, I had to get here, man, you know? But, so anyway, these bags are sitting on the porch, and so when I come in the door, I say, David, what's all this? She says, well, I want you to go somewhere with me. And I said, oh, okay. You know, I figured we're going to probably go by and get a little something on the way, you know, and, she said, well, throw those suitcases in the back while you're at it. I said, oh, okay. And so she drove me across town to my brother's house. Now, I knew something was wrong one more time when we pulled up in front of my brother's house. You know. And she got out and set the suitcases on the sidewalk, and she looked at me and said, hey, I can't do this no more. We're done. It's over. If you need some help, call me. Otherwise, I'll see you. Now, you got to realize now, this was 1987, and we got married in 78. So we had been together for a long time. I mean, we lived together for like 6 years before we got married. So we were together a long time, man, you know. And it was this relationship that, you know, I thought was sound. I mean, yeah, I did a little dope, but I mean, you know, what was wrong with that, you know? And yeah, I'd probably taken the last $50 out of the bank to go spread some dope. Wasn't no food in the refrigerator, and you know, the rent hadn't been paid or whatever, but that's how I did it, you know? And so, back to my brother's house. I knew when I got to my brother's house that things were not going to be okay. You see, because my brother was my road dog. Now, I don't know if y'all got any road dogs that you used to run with when you was out there, but he was always worse than me. And I knew damn well his rent wasn't paid. Okay? And, you know, and I knew that the next stop for us, him and I, was the Burning Barrel at the Pavarello House down on G Street. Okay? And so it wasn't long before I was sitting in the living room at my brother's house, and it didn't take long for me to remember that I had that card in my wallet that dude had given me a couple of weeks before up on that unit. And I called him, and he answered. And I said, hey, man, look, I tell you what, I got a little problem. I could really use some help with it. Maybe I could come in there and talk to somebody. And he said, sure. Why don't we plan for you to come in tomorrow? I said, well, tomorrow maybe not want to work, man, because I've got, you know, I've got some things I got to do. You know, let's try to schedule it for a few days from now, you know. And he said, well, the only appointment that I have is for tomorrow, and, you know, if you want it, you know, you need to come in, you know. And I said, well, yeah, I'll come in for an appointment, you know, what the heck, I'll go in there and see what it's all about. And so the next morning the wife came by, she picked me up, and we went to this treatment center. And when I got there, this lady that was doing intake says to me, well, she asked me a bunch of questions, and you know, and I tried to hem-haw around them and do the best I could, and finally she said, well, it looks like what we're going to do is we're going to bring you into a residential program here, and you're going to be inpatient for 30 days, And I said, what? Impatient? I said, you mean tell me I can't just come up here and you guys help me and educate me and I go home every night? I mean, that's what I was thinking, you know? I mean, what am I going to do with my work and, you know, all these other things I got going on? You know, I got bills to pay and people to see. She said, well, we got a bed open right now, and if you don't want it, there's somebody else that's waiting for it. So, and my wife kind of looked at me with that look, you know? And, okay, man. She said, yeah, we want you to check in right now. And so I went inpatient, you know, I went residential for 28 days, and you know what, and what I remember about those 28 days is that I spent a lot of time, man, just trying to get a handle on where I was at and why I was there, you know, and it was difficult, you know. I went to the groups, and I listened to the groups, and you know, for the first couple of weeks, I just kind of moped around, man. I remember some guys came up to the unit, and they said they were from that NA thing, you know, and they came into my room, and they got me when I was in, you know, detox, and they took me into the room across the hall, and they said, hey, man, look, you know, why don't you have a cup of coffee, and here's a cigarette, and we got some literature we want you to check out. And I said, okay, yeah, well, you know, I'll try reading it, you know, later, you know. And every night, man, those dudes would come up to the unit, and they'd get me out of my room, and they'd take me into the smoking room and give me a cup of coffee and give me a cigarette and hand me some literature. And I remember as soon as I got out of detox, we were able to go to outside meetings. And I remember that the first meeting that I went to for Narcotics Anonymous was a meeting in the trailers right in front of the building that I was in, outside of the treatment center, where I said I'd never go. And I remember going into that meeting that night, and it was a Monday night. There was this lady that was sitting up here at the table, and she was the chairperson for the meeting, and I looked at her and I was thinking, you know, maybe I'm in the wrong place, man. But this woman don't look like she ever did any dope, man. I mean, why is she here? You know, she kind of looks like a school teacher, you know. In fact, she kind of looks like an elementary school teacher because she was really tiny and, you know, dressed all prim and proper and shit. And I said, well, I know I did more dope than this woman ever seen, you know. And then she opened her mouth. And she started telling her story, man, and she talked about doing armed robberies. She talked about riding Harley Davidsons. She talked about doing long time in the penitentiary. And I'm sitting there with my mouth open, man, and I'm like, what? You did that? You know, and I was shocked, man. I honestly was, because I could have swore this woman was, you know, she was an elementary school teacher, man. You know? But that's, you know, that's, and the thing that, you know, the thing that I got in that moment was that I knew I was in the right place. And the only reason I knew I was in the right place is because I identified with the insanity of this disease. I recognized that in what she was sharing and what was going on in my life. And for the first time in my life, I felt at home. I felt like I belonged somewhere. You know? And of course, it didn't take long for that to pass. I was still trying to get up out of there, you know. And I remember somebody telling me to, you know, that they suggest 90 meetings in 90 days. And I thought, 90 meetings in 90 days? Man, you mean to tell me you guys want me to come back here for 90 more days? I'm doing 28. What is this 90 days thing, man? You know? And they said, get a sponsor. And I didn't know what a sponsor was, but, you know, they said, read the literature. Well, I had already, you know, gotten the literature from these guys that were coming up to my room. And so by the time I got out of treatment, I had read the basic text from cover to cover. Now, I knew, see, and one of the things about me is you got to realize that my ego, once I know something, I know it. And I'm going to tell you, I know it. And I, when I was new, man, that was my, that was the, every other word out of my mouth was, I know. You tell me something, and the first thing I say is, I know. And I saw this guy at this meeting. I, this was after I got out of treatment. I saw this guy who'd been coming around, you know, and at that time he had about like 16 years or something, you know. And I couldn't believe anybody had 16 years without using any dope, man. That was just impossible. I couldn't believe anybody had a year, you know. Nevertheless, 16, and this guy was loud. I'm going to tell you, he was loud and boisterous and I was afraid of the dude, to be honest with you. But I thought, you know what, man? They say, you know, find somebody that you can, you know, you think you could talk to and relate to, you know. And I was pretty loud myself sometimes, you know. And I was pretty, you know, bodacious sometimes. And so I saw a lot of me in this guy, you know, or what I thought was me anyway. And so I asked him to be my sponsor, you know. And the first time I asked him to be my sponsor, he said no. I said, yeah, man, I knew it. I knew you guys was full of shit. You talk all this stuff about helping people, and the first time I come up to somebody and ask them to be my sponsor, they say no. And so I was talking that smack, and somebody overheard me, this lady overheard me, and she says, she comes up to me, and she says, Barbara H., and, you know, I love her dearly. She's got 31 years, 32 years. And she says, well, Ken, you know what? Maybe it's not about you. And I said, what? The whole world revolves around me. What you mean it's not about me? She said, yeah, maybe it's not about you. Maybe it's about him. Why don't you wait a couple of weeks and go back and ask him again? You know, and so I took that suggestion, you know, and I asked him to be my sponsor, and you know what, man, and I found a loving and caring person. You know, when I needed him most, he was there for me. You know, and he was there for a lot of other addicts. You know, and he was my sponsor for 9 years. And when he passed away, you know what, I was devastated. You know, I was totally devastated. We worked the steps and, you know, we worked the traditions. You know, and he helped me through some of the hardest times in my life. You know, and I had more of an intimate relationship with him than I ever had with any other human being in my life. And, you know, he'd take me to meetings, and even when I didn't want to go to meetings, I'd tell him, I'd say, hey, man, I'm not going to go tonight. I'm going to stay home and watch the football game. He said, no, man, get in the damn truck. Give me that bullshit. Get in the damn truck. We're going to a meeting, you know. And we're going to stay after the meeting, so don't plan nothing for after the meeting, you know, because we're going to coffee and hang out. And so that's what I did, man, and he took me under his wing, and that's what he did, man. He took me to meetings, and he got me involved in service. I remember when, you know, I was in service when the California Mid-State region was forming, you know. The last year that the five regions, the five initial regions or areas were in, Northern California was in 1988. That was the last year that they were in that in the Northern California region. In 1989, the California Mid-State region was formed. And I was a part of that. You know? And it feels good to be a part of something like that. To be a part of something that's grown to be what it is today. And, you know, there's a region of areas that are working with addicts all over the place, man. all over the Central Valley. There's so many addicts that have come in this program since I got here. It's amazing to me. This program has grown so much. And I have to give credit where credit is due, because see, when I came in here in 1987 in Fresno, there were meetings every day of the week of Narcotics Anonymous. Now you may be surprised to hear that, but there were meetings every day of the week. And I attribute that to my predecessors, you see, because they were busy working to make sure that there were doors that were open for addicts like me. They were in service. They were teaching me how to be in service. They were giving me unconditional love all the time. And so being a part of that formation program for the California Mid-State region was an enormous part of my recovery. I also got to participate in the first California Mid-State Regional Convention, was held in Fresno. I was the merchandise chair. Tell about ego. Man, you find out how big an ego you got when you become the merchandise chair for a convention. You know, I told them, I want 362 jackets. We're going to need, hell, we weren't going to have 500 people at the Saturday night meeting. I need 420 t-shirts, 1,000 coffee mugs. Well, I'll tell you what, they put me in my place quick. But thank God, man. Thank God there was service for me to do, you know, because it kept me here. You know, what I realized after being here and that doing that 90 meetings in 90 days, what I realized was that I hadn't taken nothing. It had been 90 days and I hadn't taken nothing, man. That in itself was a miracle. The same dope fiend that couldn't get up in the morning without a dope in his body, man. I couldn't move without having that dope in front of me. And I was clean 90 days. And not only that, I knew what to do on the 91st day. And nobody had to tell me. Go to another meeting. So I went to another meeting. And I thank God that I was able to do that. You see, it's the simple things around here that make this program what it is. That's why we keep it simple here. We don't try to complicate this. You see, as an addict, I know my brain is complicated enough. The disease that lives between my ears is complicating everything in my life. So I have to keep it real simple. I have to do things real simple. Somebody tells me to show up, I show up. Somebody tells me to be of service, I'm of service. I had to learn how to take direction in here. Because my program and my direction never worked. And I look back on my history and I find that it never worked for me. You see? It wasn't until I got here and I started having somebody in this program point out my behaviors. I remember this lady, Irene Key, she used to say, Irene Tellis, she used to say, love me enough to call me on my shit when I get out of line. Because I'm an addict. And we die from our behaviors. That's what happens to addicts. Our behaviors take us back out there into the insanity of this disease. And we die. Addicts die here. This is a life and death program. But we find recovery here. We do find recovery here. You know, I need to tell you a couple more things about what happened for me. You know, my oldest son, my son, I don't have one oldest, you know, he is a practicing addict now. and has been. I turned him out when he was 12 years old on his first dope. I gave it to him. And it took a lot for me to get to a place where I could accept my behavior in that. And accept that that's, you know, take responsibility for that. And make amends to him. But I remember the speaker that I heard at the second New Year's Eve speaker meeting that I went to in Fresno. His name was Pepe. And there's some people in this room that remember Pepe. He was a very loving man. And he was one of the founders of Narcotics Anonymous in Northern California. And I remember we were at the speaker meeting, and Pepe says that addicts suffer from two things. We suffer from the ego mind, and in contrast to that, we have the love mind. And the ego mind is the mind that is self-destructive. That's the place where we go when we're trying to kill this guy in here. See, we talk about committing suicide, and that's what I was doing before I got here, and you showed me how not to. And you helped me deflate that ego that was killing me, and that pride that kept me out there in the disease. And he talked about the love mind, and that being a place where we find empathy, where we find peace, where we find compassion. And I had a hard time with that one for a long time because, like I said, I really never knew what intimacy was all about. You know, I thought that was something that me and the wife did when, you know, when we were together, you know? But that wasn't... That had nothing to do with it. That was my own distorted vision and illusion. And it wasn't until I got this phone call at 3 o'clock in the morning. And it was CPS calling me. I just moved into this really beautiful home. I had a great job. I was making more money than I ever made in my life before. I was 11 years clean. Everything in my life was going the way it should. Or so I thought. And this call at 3 o'clock in the morning was CPS. And they called because they found my daughter-in-law in the car, in the front seat of the car, smoking crack. And my 3-year-old grandson was in the back seat asleep. And they took her to jail and took him to CPS. And I never dreamed that I would have the love for another human being until I had experience looking in the eyes of my grandson at 3 years old when we went to pick him up that night. And how afraid he was, and how precious he was. And I think about where this disease has taken us, and my family, for generations, this disease has taken my family. It's like a war zone when I look around. And I was determined that once. The disease was not going to take my grandson, not my precious 3-year-old grandson. And so I took him home, and I had the opportunity, because his dad was in Wasco at the time, and I remember I talked to his dad, and I told him, I said, you know what, I got your back. I got this one. You don't have to worry about this. This is taken care of. And he came and he lived with us, with me and his grandma. You know, he called me Poppy and he called her Grammy. and he lived with us until he was 12 years old. And at that time, his mom had had gotten clean, and she was 3 years clean. And he wanted to go back and live with his mom. And I'm so grateful, you know, because God put me in a place. God gave me the opportunity to be prepared for something that I never dreamed that I'd be prepared for. He was preparing me all along for this opportunity to take care of my grandson. And you know what? He's 18 today. He's 18 now. Goes about 6'2". Weighs about 240 pounds. And instead of saying Poppy, he says Poppy. Calls me on the phone, Poppy. What are you doing? But I hear that little voice, that little tiny voice in him every time he calls me. And you know what, man? What a life I have today. What an opportunity, you know. My father's anonymous. And somebody's got to watch the time because I will go over. God has just been, I've been so blessed, you know. You know, I was on my way to the 50th anniversary celebration of Narcotics Anonymous in San Diego in 2003. And I got my grandson and my granddaughter and my wife and my daughter, and you know, we're all headed down to San Diego, you know, for the convention, and then we're going to spend time after the convention. We're going to go do all the parks and, you know, the zoo and all these things we got planned to go do, right? And so we're on the freeway and we're driving out to 405, and I get a phone call, and it's my sister. And I need to back up a little bit because I didn't tell you about 5 years clean. I got a phone call from my brother, the one that I had been running with, and he wanted no parts of Narcotics Anonymous. And he called me up and he said, "Hey, look, you know, I'm really in trouble. These guys, they were just here, and they put a real whooping on me, and you know what? They said they were going to come back in a couple of hours if I didn't have their money. They were going to, you know, they were going to just, you know, do it all over again." And so I knew he was in trouble, so I went and picked him up from his apartment, and and he was willing, you know, he was willing at that time. And I remember I called my sponsor and I said, "You know what? This is what's going on." And he says, "Okay, this is what I want you to do." And he gave me direction. He said, "Look, I want you to take him home, get him something to eat, and then I want you to take him to a meeting, and, tonight." And that was on a Monday. And he says, "What I want you to do is I want you to, and on Tuesday, I want you to bring him to the Tuesday meeting and have some clothes, you know, and stuff with him when he comes to the meeting." And I thought, why did he want me to do that? But anyway, so, you know, I by 5 years clean, I knew how to take direction here, folks. It didn't, you know, I didn't ask why, or I didn't say I know anymore. Okay? So anyway, Tuesday meeting, I show up with my brother, with his clothes in the back, and we go through the meeting. After the meeting, he says, "Look, you're coming with me, and you're going home, and you know, that's what it's going to be." And so he moved my brother into his house, and he kept him there, you know, for the next week while he worked on getting him into treatment. And he didn't even bother to ask me for help with that. He just said, "This is what we're going to do." And he did it. And by the end of the week, my brother was in a residential treatment program. And I was amazed, to be honest with you, because I didn't think he'd get there. I didn't think he was going to be willing to do it, but he was. And, you know, and, 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 You know, and that's the kind of thing that the Narcotics Anonymous has been there to do for me when I couldn't do it myself. He told me, he says, look, you're too close to the problem. See? You're too close. You know? You're going to have too many other things to think about other than just trying to get this guy into some help. And he was right. I absolutely was. I was thinking of all kinds of stuff. You know, I got to move this apartment. I got to go get him this. I got to do that. You know, and he kept it real simple. And so anyway, my brother Greg got clean, and he stayed clean in this program for 11 years. And, you know, he started working in treatment. You know, he worked in treatment. He worked in, you know, recovery. He worked at Corcoran Prison, you know, as a counselor. You know, he went to work in Vacaville Prison. He ended up working in Sacramento. He was a supervisor of the Turning Point Treatment Program in Sacramento. And, 11 years clean. I mean, he was giving this stuff back in a way that was unbelievable, you know. And, so I'm on this trip down south, and my sister calls, and she says, look, they found Greg dead in his room, in his apartment, and I guess, you know, something had happened over the weekend, and he passed away. He had a congestive heart failure, and passed away, And I remember one more time that, you know, I was devastated. I didn't know, I didn't know what to do, you know. And this was in 2003, and I changed sponsors because my other sponsor passed away, and so I changed sponsors. And I called my new sponsor, and I told him, I said, look, man, this is what's going on. And he says, look, I want you to get on a plane. I want you to go to Sacramento and see what you can do, you know, to help out, you know, with things. And so that's what I did, you know. And that's the way it's been for me. Even today, you know, with 26 plus years clean, when somebody tells me this is what, in Narcotics Anonymous, when somebody tells me this is what you need to do, Ken, I listen. You see? Because they're sharing experience with me. They're not just sharing off the top of their head. They're not sharing out of ego and pride. This program is about one thing, and that's unconditional love. And that's what I've gotten since I've walked through the doors of this program. People have loved me when I couldn't love myself. And I remember getting off that airplane in Sacramento, and my sister picked me up at the airport, and she and we talked on the way over to the apartment. And I remember when I got to the apartment, it was kind of strange because I knew where his apartment was, and I saw these people standing out in front of the apartment, and I didn't understand what was going on. Had they not, you know? She said they had come to get his body, and they, you know, and if he wasn't there, we're gonna have to go down to the, you know, to the morgue or whatever, and. And when I got out of the car, a couple of these people walked up to me and said, look, Ken, we're from Narcotics Anonymous, your brother's fellowship here in Sacramento. And we want you to know that the only thing that you got to do is stay clean, and we'll take care of the rest. And I was like, I was amazed. You know, the fellowship up there, his fellowship, showed up. And greeted me. And I remember when we went to the funeral, we did the funeral, and, you know, there were so many people there. It was unbelievable. And there was no room inside the church. This little church was about the size of this room. And there was no room in the church for the people that were standing outside. Because not only had all of the fellowship in Sacramento showed up, but hell, half the fellowship in Fresno showed up. And I was like, basking in your love one more time. And I thank God for my Narcotics Anonymous one more time. Because you helped me get through a time when I just knew. I had reservations. I knew that if something happened to him, I was going out, man. and I didn't have to get loaded. And I got to stay here. And I got to be there for some other addict that had the same kind of thing going on. And I had experience, and I could tell them what to do. And I could give them direction. The same kind of direction that I take. When I tell you that I thank God for this program, I really, truly mean that. There's no question. There's no question. I will go to any length for an addict in these rooms, except for taking something. It's one thing I won't do is get loaded. You see, because I know what's waiting for me out there. You know, and I continue to work in service. I continue to be a service in Narcotics Anonymous, and you know what? I just recently got back into H&I, and I'm doing service at Avenal Prison. Pleasant Valley Prison. Thanks, Manuel. You reminded me. At Pleasant Valley State Prison, and I'm going in there once a month and on a panel with a bunch of guys. And last time we went in, there were 15 guys from the fellowship that went into that prison. We had five guys at every yard. We had five guys at each yard. And you know what? If you've ever been in prison, you know what it's like to be in prison and not have anybody give a shit about you being there. And I'm going to tell you, when we walk into that prison on that Wednesday night, five deep into a yard, they know that there's some love coming up in there. Those guys appreciate it. They truly do. Being of service in Narcotics Anonymous has been a phenomenal thing for me. I love it, you know. My wife tells me that I spend too much time. You know, recently I've been going to meetings on a regular basis, man. I remember my sponsor. Is it good time? Okay. I remember my sponsor when I got here. He had 16 years clean. He was going to meetings 7 days a week. And I didn't understand that. Why is he going to meetings 7 days a week? He's been here 16 years. Today I know why. There's nothing else in my life that gives me more joy than to show up at a meeting in Narcotics Anonymous and shake the hand of a newcomer and welcome them. And say, keep coming back to this program because your life will change as mine has. Anyway, man, like I said, I'm really grateful. Thank you guys for having me down here, and I love it, and I love being here, and I love this fellowship. I know a lot of people in this area, you know, and I've gotten clean with them, been with them for many, many years, and some of them are in the room tonight, you know, and I just, you know, thank God, man, you know. So anyway, with that, thank you for allowing me to share.